My castaway this week is a director, writer and actor. At Cambridge in the 50s, he was a star of the footlights and a young Turk of a director, so much so that he walked straight out of university into a job at the Royal Court Theatre. From there, he moved into writing and performing satirical sketches, first at Peter Cook's Club in Soho, and then on television in Not So Much a Programme, More a Way of Life. His impersonations of Harold Wilson, Jomo Kenyatta and Edward Heath became part of the national diet, eagerly consumed by audiences enjoying the new found freedoms which satire represented. Then it all stopped. Satire went out of fashion, and by his own admission, he went off the rails. But suddenly he came back. Partnered by his best friend, John Fortune, he appeared on The Rory Bremner Show in a series of witty sketches sending up politicians, big business and upper-class snobberies. "What I'm doing now," he says, "is exactly what I was doing 30 years ago. I haven't developed at all." Here's John Bird. Do you mind, John?
I do quite, yes. I mean, I enjoy doing what I do very much. But I always think that by now I should have a late period, you know, like Brahms had a late period, or, you know, where everything is very spare and abstract. But I don't have a late period. I have my early period has,
but is it
has
a more,
gone on.
Is it a more confident period then? Because you've done it before.
I suppose so, yes. I suppose so. One also says it never gets any easier doing what we're doing. And like most people, when I've done a piece, I always think I'm never going to get an idea again. You know, that's the end of it.
It's because it has to be so topical.
Yes, it has to be topical. It also has to be felt. Otherwise, you're in the position of kind of looking around for and manufacturing an attitude. We both, I mean, John Fortune and I both have quite strong feelings from time to time, although not always about the same sort of thing.
Well, which helps, of course, but by definition, because you've been on the Rory Bremner Show throughout the 90s, you've been attacking the Tories, whether it's sleaze or arms sales or racist ministers, as you've seen them. How does it compare now, attacking New Labour?
Well, I think at first we did actually find it very difficult, partly because, of course, the nature of the end of the Tory regime was the same as it always is when empires collapse, that it becomes decadent and sort of shameless in a way. And the feeling was that they had so completely lost their grip. And the only thing that they were interested in was kind of the last little bits at the bottom of the pig's trough for their friends in the city, you know, sort of selling off this and selling off that and doing it in the rail and getting the railways. And I know, well, let's split the railways up into 62 different companies and this and the rest of it. Whereas everybody was so relieved when they went and Tony Blair got in, but particularly when the other lot went, that certainly we found the first series with a New Labour quite difficult to do, because it takes time for the character of a government to establish itself.
And now it has?
I think now it has, yes.
What is it for you?
What is most irritating about it is its self-satisfaction, its self-righteousness, and what I suppose they would call it is pragmatism, but what is in fact a desperate kind of running around looking for what is the most vote profitable line to take. I mean, the particular example is of the pensions. You know, that here we have Gordon Brown, a rigorous minister with a definite programme from which he will not be diverted, so that he puts the pensions up by 75 pence a week. And then, as another matter of principle, he said, no, that's not good, because we lost the growth of the council elections on the basis of that, so we'll put them up by whatever it is. Not to say, well, old people should have a certain amount of dignity and they should be given assistance. But no, we need to be told by the election results that we have got our principles wrong.
Tell me about your first record.
First record? Well, this is me being on a desert island. Not a milieu which I think would show me at my best, but I would like to wake up in the morning and have a bit of energy and a bit of lightheartedness. This is the Mendelssohn Octet, an absolutely miraculous piece of music, which is so full. He wrote it when he was 16, and it's of Mozartian magic, I think, this.
The Smetana and Janáček quartets playing part of Mendelssohn's Octet for Strings in E-flat, music to help you start the day on your desert island, John Bird. Do you always need music to start? I mean, you mention energy. You need to wake yourself up.
Yes. When I was directing at the Royal Court, and I was on the staff there, George Devine, who was the artistic director there, I remember he said, "It's totally you. You've got no energy." And it's absolutely true. I'm a sort of laid-back kind of lazy person.
You've said before now that you might have ended up running the National Theatre if only you'd had Trevor Nunn's energy.
If only I had half of Trevor Nunn's energy, yes.
But do you think it hindered your career, lack of energy?
Well, I sort of make a living and I kind of carry on. I'm 63 years old and I think, well, it's rather remarkable that anybody who's so indolent as I am can actually survive.
So you decided to be proud of it?
Well, I'm not proud of it, actually, but there comes a time when, there was a time in my life I didn't accept it and that led to all sorts of problems.
Okay. Well, I want to talk to you about that, but I just want to just go back to certainly my very early memories of you, which was you as Harold Wilson, which absolutely struck a bell with us all in the mid-60s. When you found him, I mean, was it love at first sight, as it were? Could you just do him?
Well, no. What happened was that we'd been doing cabaret theatre at the establishment, which was a sort of nightclub come theatre in Soho. And we used to do politicians, but because it was the sort of audience which, you know, it was an audience of 200 people or something, it was very sketchy. But when I came to do it on television, I thought, well, if I'm saying I am the Prime Minister, I am Harold Wilson, I really ought to make some sort of effort to try and be like him, because one of the great strengths of doing that satire on television is that you're using exactly the same medium as the politician is. So I was very, very lucky all through the time I was doing satirical programmes for the BBC, because it is said that everybody can do somebody, and luckily I could do Harold Wilson. Mm. Doing that sort of satirical programme, or doing satirical sketches like that on television, one of the advantages of it is that if you do something as Harold Wilson, or like Rory does as Tony Blair, that when people actually see the real Harold Wilson and the real Tony Blair, there's a sort of echo you know, that they say those, because what I was always trying to do with Wilson was to say those things which everybody knew Wilson was thinking, but which Wilson never said.
Like,
this is a very long time ago, see, when I was doing this, but I things like, well, good evening. I'd like to speak to you tonight. Sincerely, honestly, and directly. Still, you can't break the habits of a lifetime. And that's the only piece of evidence I can remember.
Tell me about your second record.
The second record is Lottie Lenya singing Brecht and Weill. And this is one of the records which will have great resonance with me, because I in the 60s, worked with Lottie Lenya. And it was one of the great working experiences of my life, this.
Ach, bedenken Sie, Herr Jakob Schmidt. Ach, bedenken Sie, was man für 30 Dollar kriegt. 10 Paar Strümpfe und sonst nichts. Ich bin aus Havanna, meine Mutter war eine Weiße. Sie sagte oft zu mir, mein Kind, verkauf dich nicht für ein paar Dollarnoten, so wie ich es tat. Schau dir an, was aus mir geworden ist. Ach, bedenken Sie, Herr Jakob Schmidt. Ach, bedenken Sie, Herr Jakob Schmidt.
Lotte Lenya as Jenny singing Ach, bedenken Sie, the Havana song from Kurt Weill's Mahagoni. Lotte Lenya, Royal Court, towards what, the end of the 50s, you were directing her in an evening of Brecht. You would have been 22 years old.
Yes, I was 22. I joined the Royal Court Theatre from Cambridge as a director. I had the grand title of Assistant Artistic Director at the Royal Court. It was a wonderful time to be there.
But why? At 22 years old, I mean, you must have been a prodigy of some kind.
No, I think it was like most things, luck, really. But I was up at Cambridge, and I decided to be an academic, or at least I was thinking about it. So I started doing postgraduate work. And I'd happened to read a play that had won an Observer competition by N.F. Simpson, called A Resounding Tinkle. I thought, this is a really funny play, and I thought, I've got to do this. So in the middle of my first postgraduate year, I took the theatre on my own, and Peter Cook was in it, Alan Bronn was in it, Timothy Birdsong, his license, was in it, Jeff Pratty, who's a Conservative cabinet minister later on, was in it, and we did this, and Bill Gaskell came up to see it.
From the Royal Court.
And he was very generous, Bill Gaskell, because he said, you realise you've directed this completely wrongly, don't you? Because it should have been taken very slowly, and you took it very quickly. But I was offered this job, so I gave up the academic life after the first year. Mm. And I'd been there for, I think it was 1959, and we decided to do, they wanted to do this Brecht evening of excerpts of Brecht. And Lenya agreed to be in it. And I was getting more and more nervous. And George Devine said, right, so she was arriving on a Saturday night. So on Sunday, you've got to meet her and take her out for lunch. And I went to pick her up in my old car. I rang the bell, and she was looking absolutely very, very grim, very sort of roasted crab. And I said, hello, I'm John Bernard, I'm the director. And he said, whoa. And she came down, got into the car. We drove to Border Street, parked the car, got in the restaurant. And apart from saying hello on the doorstep, we sat down at a table and hadn't exchanged a single word. I was too nervous, and she was too grumpy. And I said, what would you like to drink? She said, a gimlet. So I didn't know what a gimlet is. Luckily, the waiter did. So he brought this little glass, put it in front of her. And I thought, I've got to say something. I really have got to say something soon. Otherwise, this is not going to be good for rehearsal. So I said, I made a sort of sweeping gesture with my hand and knocked her gimlet all over her dress. Well, luckily, she thought this was very, very amusing. And from that moment, actually, we got on terribly, terribly well. We had a wonderful relationship. She was great.
Tell me about your next record.
I've always loved Haydn. I've always loved his musical personality and his personality in general. When I was coming to do this programme, I thought I must have a Haydn quartet, because nobody has ever done better than Haydn at writing quartets. I mean, Beethoven wrote quartets which equaled his, but as a body, they are unsurpassed.
The Giovanni Quartetto Italiano, playing part of the first movement of Haydn's String Quartet No. 5 in D major. What about your family background, John? Were there political or creative influences there?
No, not really. My father was a chemist, had a chemist shop. My mother was just, as people went those days, a housewife.
Where was this?
In Nottingham, yes.
And you went to an ordinary school?
I failed my 11 plus and was sent from primary school to a secondary modern school. And it's a very kind of weird story, looking back at it now, because in those days, probably, that if you failed your 11 plus, that settled you for life. If you went to a secondary modern school, your future was more or less mapped out for you. But if you went to a grammar school, possibilities were different. As I say, I failed my 11 plus. I went for a year to this secondary modern school, and it was a sort of piece of complete random chance that the headmaster, Harry Davis, who took over the high pavement grammar school where I would have gone had I passed my 11 plus, he was a great opponent of it. And he said, I would like to look at some of the papers of the borderline cases of that year, and I will pick out one, stick him into the second year in the bottom class, and I won't tell any of the staff. He told me this after the day I got my scholarship to King's College, Cambridge. He told me this story.
So that you were an experiment.
That I was an experiment. And I suddenly uprooted, much to my dismay, from the secondary modern school where I'd settled in, and was stuck in two for the second year at grammar school.
Record number 4.
Debussy is a composer who I rather think of in the way I think of as Haydn, as being a sort of exemplar of what music can be. I love Debussy because of his slipperiness, the kind of ever-changing light in his pieces. I'm not a fan of Debussy the impressionist. I'm a fan of Debussy the transformer of material. And Jeu, which is his last orchestral score, is a wonderful example. It's very short, but in which the material, and some of the material is in itself very beautiful, but very fragmentary, constantly shifts. It's like seeing sunlight in cloud glittering across a glittering sea.
The end of Debussy's Jeu, played by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, conducted by Bernard Haitink. So, John Bird, Cambridge, directing Footlights, onto the Royal Court, couple of years there. During all this time, you've written and you've directed, but you haven't performed. That doesn't happen until you get to join Peter Cook at his club in Soho, the establishment. Why did you suddenly decide to perform?
Well, I didn't decide to perform. I was just going to write for it. That was the idea. And John Fortune was going to direct. Peter was also going to write. And we had auditions, but nobody who... Either people weren't sort of flexible enough to do it, or it was actually what it really was. There was nobody who was any good would do it for the amount of money that we were offering. So
it does include Barry Humphries, am I right?
I think it includes Barry Humphries, yeah. So Peter said something which Peter has been said to me for various reasons. Like, why don't you do it just for the first 3 months and we can get somebody who can do it properly? You know, and so when the place opened, I was performing.
But it is what funny men did then, as it were, isn't it? I mean, Alan Bennett and Jonathan Miller before you, and then Peter Cook and you, and John Wells and so on. There was no division between the two skills, writing and performing. Does the one, do you think, spoil you for the other? Or
no, the sort of stuff we do, I mean, the sort of stuff that I did then, as you say, I'm still doing. As I say, I'm still doing, yes. There's a great shorthand involved. I mean, you have... It's something like you want to say something about something, and so if you kind of sit down and write it for somebody else to perform, it's an enormous amount of work, really. And whereas if you... do it for yourself to perform, it's really easy.
Well, but aren't you also saying if you sit down and write, it all gets a bit kind of plonky, whereas if you sit there and feel it and do it,
yes.
I'm helping you here.
You are helping me, yeah, and I really need it. I feel that because this is the great thing that working with John Fortune does. If I'm working on my own writing stuff, which I still do, it's pulling teeth. It really is. But as soon as John Fortune arrives and sits in the chair next to me, everything is much, much easier.
But it's not just that. It's all those little nuances, I presume.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Just when you're focused up and you've got someone to bat off, like Fortune, all of a sudden... Absolutely. It all starts to happen. I mean, how much do you script it beforehand these days?
Well, these days we script it more than we used to. I was looking back at some of the notes we had, and they were just like four sentences on a sheet of paper, and we just would go in with that. And now, although we don't script it in the dialogue sense, we do write the points down much more. In a much more detailed way than we did.
And is it true that sometimes people ring in because they think you're actually reading out political transcripts?
When we started, that was the case, yes. I didn't know quite how to take it because you thought, well, it can't be very funny in that case. But I was, I suppose, pleased on the Verismo level that we were getting it, the style right.
Echo number five. Tell me about this one.
Well, when I was in the establishment, we took over a club in New York. We took over the old El Morocco nightclub, which was wonderful, and we opened it as the New York establishment. And we were also opposite, on the other side of 54th Street, a club called the Embers, which is a big jazz club at the time. A lot of jazz people used to go. And I met Dizzy there. In fact, Dizzy Gillespie and I decided we were going to learn to play chess. So we got a chessboard and sat and sort of taught ourselves chess. But we were so bad at it that if the game didn't end within five moves, we had no idea what to do after that. And I actually played piano with the Oscar Peterson rhythm section, I play piano. I played the occasional note while they kind of did their thing behind me. But this is Jerry Mulligan. Jerry Mulligan became a good friend of mine in New York. And this is the record from that time. This is 1962, and his concert jazz band, a wonderful band, playing a piece by Bob Brookmeyer.
Jerry Mulligan and his concert jazz band playing Bob Brookmeyer's Big City Blues and Memories of Bird in America. Meanwhile, back here in England, mid-60s by now, satire, your thing, was well into its stride, and we'd fallen hook, line and sinker, for that was the week that was. The first thing to say is that, according to Ned Sheeran, you thought up the title, is that right?
Apparently so. I must have done it in my sleep, I don't remember it.
Second thing to say is, you did a pilot for it.
Yes, I did one of the pilots, yeah, absolutely.
Third thing to say is, you suggested David Frost should front it, not you.
Well, I was offered, Ned said, would I like to front it? And at that, about that time, I'd agreed to go to Chicago with the establishment. So it was a question of whether I should go to America or front this new show. And I chose to go to America. So I was sharing a flat with David Frost at the time. He was a researcher for ATV at the old ITV company. And he was doing cabaret 2-3 times a week at the Blue Angel. And I said to Ned, well, why don't you go and look at David Frost? And I went to look at David Frost, and as a result of that, he is now Sir David Frost.
But in fact, you came, when you did come back, you were in the sequel, Not So Much a Programme, More a Way of Life, also fronted by David Frost. But then, of course, satire seemed to dwindle after that, didn't it?
Yes, it did, because there'd been an awful lot of it. It'd been very fashionable, and because it was a television show, and that Not So Much a Programme was on 26 weeks of the year, 3 times a week, live. And he was an enormous consumer of material and just energy. And it was just very, very hard to keeping up any kind of standard. And I think we just, weren't up to it, really.
Next piece of music.
This is Brahms' second piano concerto. The lady I did with, Libby, we've been together now for 23 years. When I met her, one of the first occasions which I remember was when she performed this in Southwark Cathedral. And this is Pellini who has a stab at it, but I still like Libby's performance best.
Maurizio Pollini with the Berlin Philharmonic and Claudio Abbado playing part of the final movement of Brahms' Concerto for Piano and Orchestra No. 2 in B flat major. The piece your partner Libby, John Bird, was playing when you met. She kind of rescued you, really, didn't she?
Well, she did. I mean, that wasn't the purpose of our relationship. I mean, I'm very, very lucky because I imagine it's quite rare to kind of meet the person that you recognise as the person you want to be with and share your life. And from the moment I set eyes on her, that's how I felt about Libby. And it was amazing that my judgment about that was so right, because I had started taking pills to keep this famous lack of energy, to counteract the lack of energy, and I'd become very addicted to amphetamine. But one thing I would say is that I did not take them recreationally. The opposite of that. I took them because I thought it would help me to work. I thought the idea was that it was giving me this energy I didn't have, and then I could sit up all night and work. But in fact, of course, what happens is that after a very short time, you do actually sit up all night and work, but you produce complete kind of rubbish. And I had a very bad time, and I gave Libby a very bad time.
How low did you get?
I got pretty paranoid, yeah.
Suicidal?
Yes, I would say almost suicidal.
And what would you put it all down to? What was it about, fundamentally?
I think it was fundamentally about, I was terrified of just being, as it were, myself. I was terrified of that that I was a sort of empty person, really, and that I needed all this stimulant in order to do anything. And she... I mean, I owe her everything, really. But, I mean, I owe her being brought back from this chasm. But much more importantly, I owe her the positive aspect of my life, which is, you know, to really love somebody.
And this next piece is another memory of her.
This next piece is another memory of Libby. Libby was a concert pianist. And she performed in piano duets with her partner, her piano partner Bernard King. And one of the things that her sort of party pieces was the piano duet version of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky.
Mm-hmm.
It's a staggeringly difficult thing to perform. I mean, this is not even two pianos. This is one piano with four hands, and so they're always crossing each other. Now. The most nervous I've ever been in public performance is at one of these recitals which they gave. Their page turner didn't turn up, and they said, "Would you like to turn the page of this?" Now, it was absolutely terrifying because as a page turner, you can only mess something up. You know, nobody ever goes to a concert and says, "I particularly enjoyed the page turning." But on the other hand, if you turn it, you know, 5 bars early, or even worse, 10 bars late, or perhaps even worse, you'll pull the whole score off the piano, which is quite possible to do, especially when there are two of them sitting there and not one. I thought, I could only make a complete hash of this.
Rocca Eden and Alexander Tamir playing the end of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. So, John Bird, as we've said, you're back where you started on television, a sitcom coming up for BBC One, I think, about lawyers called Chambers, which of course began here on Radio 4, didn't
That's
it?
That's right.
More Bremner shows, now called Bremner, Bird and Fortune.
Yes, Rory Bremner's insistence, I have to say.
And therefore, a desert island, not least for that, but certainly for that anyway, totally unappealing to you.
I wouldn't be good, I don't think.
Oh, really?
At the building of shelters, or no, absolutely not. No.
Or life alone.
I'm not sure. I don't think John Fortune's wife once buried his screwdriver in order to stop him doing DIY work. I don't think, but luckily I wouldn't recognise what a screwdriver looks like.
But even with your favourite pieces of music, just you could not possibly flourish in that environment, could you?
Not for any considerable period of time, I don't think. I mean, I don't mind particularly my own company for a bit, but I'm intensely unpractical.
Boulez is your last choice. Why? Why do you admire him so much?
Probably because for the virtues which are the opposite of mine, for the kind of the energy and the rigorous application of principle to everything. But what I admire about the music is the brilliance of the invention and the wonderful glittering sound world that is produced. And this piece is his masterpiece.
Pierre Boulez conducting the Ensemble Intercontemporain, playing part of his composition, Répond. If you could only take one of those 8 records, John Bird, which one would you take?
I said, actually, if I think this really serious, if I could only take one record, I probably wouldn't take any of them. I'd take The Art of Fugue, which is the kind of primer of Western music. But if I'm downed and play by the rules and I take one of these, I'd take the Boulez.
Right. And what about your book?
I suppose I was tempted to say, well, I'll take one of those huge anthologies, you know, like the one, but again, playing by the rules, I would take the poems of Wallace Stevens, because I'd have plenty of time to try and work out what they meant.
And your luxury?
My first thought was a feed from the Hubble Space Telescope, and just to have a look at the universe, but then I thought that would actually reinforce my sense of being alone. So it's going to be down to 2,000 soft toilet rolls.
You've just managed to have 2 pieces of music, 2 books and 2 luxuries on your way. John Bird, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Islanders.
It's a pleasure, thank you.